This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Move on. Nothing to see here is the constant refrain from the Trump White House about any alleged involvement of the Trump presidential campaign with Russia. But that refrain is set against the constant drip, drip, drip of information being released by the media and most recently by the president's son, Donald Trump Jr. That merely adds to the suspicion that all this smoke actually originates from a fire. Of course, this is distracting from the president's agenda and that of Republicans in Congress who know that the first 6 months of any presidency is the time when most things get done. They fear these distractions are having a severely negative impact. And they're right. They're also having an impact on ordinary people who are either angered by what they see as a witch hunt or are becoming even more distrustful of this administration because of this continual shoe dropping in the Russia probe. Well, here to talk about all of that and more are four political observers, political scientists all. Dr. Adolphus Belk is with Winthrop University. Dr. Susan Roberts is with Davidson College. Dr. Eric Heberlig is from UNC Charlotte. And we welcome for the first time Dr. Elizabeth Amato from Gardner-Webb University. Good morning. Welcome to you all.
Morning.
Morning, Mike.
Morning.
What took you so long to get here?
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, for months, as I just alluded to, reporters and congressional investigators have been working or looking for a smoking gun that would confirm ties by the Trump campaign to Russia in terms of election interference. Last week, in advance of the New York Times releasing emails between Donald Trump Jr. and go-betweens, offering to set up a meeting with a Russian lawyer, ostensibly with evidence of a criminal nature involving Hillary Clinton and her ties to Russians, the president's son himself tweeted out the emails, and many pundits said, there it is, the smoking gun. Is that what it is? Eric.
Well, it's evidence of a meeting, which is what the Trumps and specifically Donald Trump Jr. had vehemently denied up to that point. So it undercuts the credibility of their denials about other things, such as no other meetings or no other attempts at coordination. So at this point, we don't know whether there was any other more substantive coordination. But the trends we've seen up till now suggest that there might be other shoes yet to drop.
But the folks on the right and the Trump, the people who love Donald Trump and voted for Donald Trump and still believe in Donald Trump, see this as a witch hunt. And they point to evidence that they've been going on this search for this smoking gun now for 6 months at least, maybe more in some cases, and so far, nothing. Is this adding fuel to their fire? Are they right, Elizabeth?
Well, they're going to be upset, right? I mean, they're going to be upset regardless of what happens. They're going to interpret it as a witch hunt, right? I mean, that's kind of their mindset right now. I think they've really dug in. They aren't distrustful. They don't have a lot of reason to regain trust. That's actually one of the things that really worries me. How do you regain the trust of people who feel disaffected and that their guy, Trump, has been just, you know, pummeled? And it's hard for them to even recognize that maybe, you know, just investigating people is a normal and decent thing to do.
Well, Carl Bernstein, I forgot which channel he was on yesterday, but he was talking about this. He's the Watergate reporter, along with Woodward. And he said that we're in the middle of this cold civil war being fueled in large part by opposing media forces, Fox News, MSNBC. How do we recover from that? Is there any historical precedent outside of the hot civil war that we fought in the 1800s? Dr. Susan Roberts.
Yeah, I think there is not much of a way out of it right now, given, as everybody says, the 24/7 news cycle. I think, to the large extent, the Republicans and Trump himself, they've been very good at framing this whole thing. They can frame it as fake news. They can frame it as a witch hunt. They can frame it as sore losers, many other frames. And the Democrats have not been very competent in framing it back, in having a succinct message that they repeat over and over and over again. And in that regard, I don't think there's a way out. I think it's he's framed it as against the media, against the liberals, and he's going to keep tweeting.
Right.
That's fuel to the fire, and I don't think anyone can manage the presidency. And you know, that let Trump be Trump. That's the only constant I see.
Adolphus, talk about this lack of framing on the parts of the Democrats. This has been going on for a long time. It's not just the Trump presidency. They've been having a difficult time defining their party and defining who they are and what they mean. And any issue, they don't march in lockstep. They all have different messages. Why haven't they learned over 25 years?
Well, Big Ten party, a lot of different constituencies, and that leads to changes or differences in messaging. Now, you know, to take a step back for a moment, if we go back to Watergate, right, because we always go back to Watergate when this conversation comes up, the events of Watergate happened in 1972. You didn't get Nixon resigning until 1974. So it's like one of your guests said the last time we were on talking about this subject, it was a slow burn. It took a long time for the information to come out. But we're at a point now where I think we have to go back to those big questions. What did the president know and when did he know it? Context matters. And when we look at the context, you have the nation's leading intelligence gathering and analyzing agencies coming to the conclusion that Russian officials tried to intervene or influence the American election to assist candidate Trump and to hurt candidate Clinton. That's now a fact. Also, we have this meeting, a meeting that was denied time and time again. And then in the email, Donald Trump Jr. says, "I appreciate that. If it's what you say, I love it." Mm-hmm. And then hours later, you have Donald Trump Sr. at a rally saying, "We have dirt. And it's going to blow your mind," right? This goes beyond standard opposition research. When it comes to research for a campaign, the first thing you want to do is get a sense of what your negatives are and how people are going to frame you. And then you want to get a sense of your opponent, right? Now, this sort of thing happens all the time. What doesn't happen all the time is people getting in a room with foreign leaders and saying, "Well, what have you been able to learn about my opponent?" Mm-hmm. That is very different, and that rises to the level that invites investigation and scrutiny.
When he released these emails last week, Donald Trump Jr. said that he did this to be totally transparent. And it turns out that that wasn't accurate because 3 days later, more information about that meeting than he originally revealed came out because in addition to the Russian lawyer, a Russian-American lobbyist, also with possible ties to Russian intelligence agencies, was revealed to have been in that meeting. So which is more troubling, the fact that the lobbyist was there or the fact that the lobbyist was there and we didn't know about it at first because he didn't tell us about it until some other source found out about it?
Well, I think that's part of what you call the drip, drip, drip. It strains credibility that you can really think. This is what I just have laughed about, and I don't mean to be offensive, but Jared Kushner said he didn't really read all of the email. The email had the subject line, "Russia, Clinton, private, confidential." Boy, I would read that whole thing. And I don't think that taking a meeting, you can say a lot in a meeting that's short. The adoption theme that they're saying was the discussion, why would you bring that up? Why would that be something that even you could remotely think was possible? I don't think just taking a short meeting where nothing came of it, and I think Adolphus has said this, the meeting – they had the meeting. I don't like the phrase, "the meeting was taken." That kind of implies that there wasn't any energy behind it. But it was to get mm-hmm. information. That was the goal. That was the expectation. And that's more important than this whole string of, like, this is all there is. This is a nothing burger. I just think that it's the meeting itself is damning evidence.
So just to give folks the benefit of the doubt here, this took place last year, this string of emails, last year, before they got into the White House, before they went to the convention, before the election was held. How much of this could simply be political rank amateurism from people who've spent their entire lives in business where this kind of behavior is not put under this kind of a microscope?
You are now president of the United States. You are expected to behave like the president of the United States.
But he wasn't the president.
Right.
No, but you are the nominee of
– But he wasn't the nominee at that point.
Well, not officially.
He wasn't the president then, but he is the president now. And if we look at the behavior since he's become president, I go back to Sally Yates. Sally Yates told him that Michael Flynn was compromised and ought not to be elevated to a key position in the cabinet in intelligence. And it was something they were willing to ignore until Flynn was radioactive and they had to let him go. And so there have been missteps Because there comes a point when once you become president-elect, you get all of this information. You get the daily national security briefings. You want to have a smooth transition from one administration to the next. And so all of this data, all of this information is now available to you.
But if you come in as a political amateur, which he is, and when most of your advisors are political amateurs, which they are, and I don't mean amateur in a pejorative sense. I just mean that they haven't made their livelihoods for the past 30 years as political operatives. And you come in with people who are already distrustful of mainstream media and of Washington.
This is Russia we're talking about. This is not Great Britain.
But if you have business ties to Russia, which are not illegal, and you want to preserve those ties.
These are people who grew up during the Cold War or end of the Cold War, who know that dealing with Russia of all countries is a signal that there's perhaps an issue here, that you don't just invite them in and accept any information they have. And if they give you information, it's probably in their interest more than yours.
And it's a great argument for getting professionals. I mean, you can chalk up a lot to amateurism and not in a non-pejorative way, but maybe this is the time during your nomination you get the professionals. Because part of the reason why we have a long nomination process is for training. It is president training, right? Because there is no other job that prepares you for that. So yeah, you get the professionals. Well, so you don't have those kind of mistakes.
And to take your point even further, you don't get family.
Yeah.
That is the real problem. And the Trump family, they've said they're very loyal to one another. Trump has made that the hallmark of his business operation. There was a very poor transition on the part of the Trump administration from the Obama administration. I just think there's such a pattern. It's not just one instance. Yes, we have celebrated. We're past the anniversary of June 9th when this initial meeting took place. That's a year. What else will come out? And on both sides of the aisle, they think something's going to come out.
Right.
And you've made the point all along that your insight as a professional business person, as a wildly successful business person, gives you a level of intellect, a level of discernment that your rivals did not have. You were supposed to be better at this because you were not in government, but you were outside of government, bringing a different insight. And to your point about the business ties, it might not be unlawful. But when you get into the Constitution and start digging into the emoluments clauses that deal with members of Congress and members of the president, the framers had the foresight to say maybe it's not a good idea that people be able to benefit from the decisions that they make in government while they are in government.
There is also the question of whether or not the campaign profited from this or any subsequent meetings, because Donald Trump Jr. insisted that no meaningful information about Hillary Clinton was provided in that meeting, and he called it a total waste of time. But in a separate interview on Friday in the Washington Post, the Russian lobbyist who was at that meeting and the Russian lawyer brought documents that she said would show the Democratic National Committee received illicit funds. And a top lawyer with the watchdog group Common Cause has since argued that any research left behind would amount to any legal contribution because opposition research has value. So which is more concerning, that the campaign may have profited in some way or the fact that the FBI was not notified that the meeting took place or any information was exchanged?
Can we choose both?
Well, I think
yes,
two.
You can.
You know, there's the growing constellation of investigations, of people that are involved. You go from a handful of Flynn to a cast of 12. I don't know how many. And I think that meaningful contribution, they wanted it to be a contribution of value, whether or not you can split hairs. But it's still the same. They're both very – I agree. It's both kind of themes or narratives.
I think even if there was no specific exchange of information at this meeting, taking the meeting and having a civil conversation is a clear signal to Russia that we're open to this. Go ahead and dump whatever you have.
Dr. Eric Heberlich, we will continue in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. Subaru. When George Zimmerman was acquitted in the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin, it ignited a national conversation revealing a clear divide. Some saw Martin as a threat, others as their son. Those reactions are explored in a documentary called What We Told Our Sons, which will be screened in Charlotte this week. It uses ordinary people's stories to spark a conversation about race and racism. That filmmaker and others continue the conversation on this program tomorrow morning at 9.
I'm John Harwood. Coming up on the next On Point, the Senate unveils its revised health care bill. We'll unpack what's in it and where it goes from here. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You're invited to join On Point coming up right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the drip, drip, drip of information that has come out about the meeting with Russians that Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort and others took in Trump Tower back in July of last year. And the emails were released last week by the president's son himself. We'll be getting into other areas of this presidency as the hour goes on with Adolphus Belk, professor of political science at Winthrop University, Susan Roberts, Dr. Susan Roberts, associate professor of political science at Davidson College, Dr. Eric Heberling, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Elizabeth Motto, also an associate professor or assistant professor of political science at Gardner-Webb University. We want to hear from you on this at the emails. We have email. We have all kinds of things available to you. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can call us and tell us how confident you are that these various investigations into Russia will get to the bottom of what happened in last year's election at 704-926-WFAE or tweet us at Charlotte Talks. When a campaign runs for office and they are approached by anybody, be it opposition research within the country about the opposition candidate or party, or in this case, what has been referred to as a hostile power, Russia, which maybe the president didn't view as a hostile power because he has dealings with these people professionally in the business world. When a campaign is approached, are they schooled? Does somebody come to a campaign from the government and say, here are the rules? If somebody from Lithuania comes to you and offers you research, you have to tell the FBI. Are they told that? And these, because these are not professional politicians.
But they have campaign managers.
But do they know? And Paul Manafort's sure. A civilian. He's not a government employee.
This is not original with me, but on the NewsHour the other day, they had on several people that were experts in the field. And one of the experts said, if you can cite it, you can write it. And that, again, as you point out, the hostile nation is a part of it. And I think people do know about opposition research. Mm-hmm. But this kind of opposition research is not standard. As Adolphus pointed out, to inoculate yourself.
Well, what I'm trying to say here is, did they know? This. There's a lot of finger pointing going on, and maybe to some people this seems like common sense, but maybe not.
But I'm not sure it matters whether it's whether they knew or not. Ignorance is no excuse under the law, right? I mean, you should have known. Somebody should have. And if you're ignorant of it, that is still on you.
I want to get back to what you said, Adolphus, a little while ago about the fact that everybody involved in this meeting insists that the president, then candidate Trump, knew nothing about the meeting or the offer of evidence against Clinton. And yet hours after the meeting was scheduled and took place, candidate Trump announced that he was drafting a major speech to make public all of the things that have taken place with the Clintons. People have interpreted that, and I think you just did, as saying he was informed that there was information coming from Russia that he could use in the campaign. But we don't know that for a fact.
We don't know that for certain, but it certainly raises a level of concern that should warrant further investigation and discussion, and not just by members of the press, but by members of Congress. Because you're talking about one of America's greatest transatlantic foes taking considerable effort to influence the outcome of an American election. And under different circumstances, maybe with a different administration, something like this would have been interpreted as a very hostile act. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite peculiar when the president's son has this meeting and 4 hours later, you're at a campaign rally bragging about having dirt that can prove that, you know, Secretary Clinton is who you say she is, that she is, in fact, Crooked Hillary. And so when we look at Congress has a clearly defined function of oversight. And this is one of those areas where I think there's enough there that folks should start asking harder and more probing questions, and that it ought not to be a partisan issue. And that's been the greatest trouble in all of this. Earlier in the conversation, we talked about how House and Senate Republicans in particular, or Republicans in general, have sort of responded to this. And we know that depending on one's party affiliation, one's own ideological preferences, you get your news from different places. And those news sources then shape your worldview. And when we look at this matter, it's yet further evidence of just how far people have drifted in the way that they see objective events. I think there was an earlier time when Republicans would have seen something like this and been much more taken aback. And some Republicans have voiced those concerns, but to date, they're in a minority.
There's still no solid evidence that the Trump campaign cooperated or colluded with Russians, but because of comments made by the president's son in that email stream, Time.com has concluded that, quote, they certainly wanted to, and that overrides the months of denials from the Trump orbit that there was anything to do that there was anything to do what the president has repeatedly called a witch hunt. I kind of mistyped that, I think, but do you agree with that, Eric, that this reverses everything the president has said over the last couple
of years. I mean, the Trump campaign and Trump personally over the past 6 months to a year have been pushed back very aggressively against any talk that there's been any links to Russia. And that's led to a lot of speculation about, well, why are they defending this so much when, as they note, the evidence at that point was quite skimpy. Well, when you have incidents like this where there actually is a meeting, the kind of thing that they've denied specifically has happened, it lends credibility to the speculation that, well, they're pushing back very hard because there is very damning evidence to come out that that suggests that there's improper relationships between the Trump campaign and Russia.
What is head-scratchingly inexplicable, at least to me, and I think to many others, is what Adolphus Belk just said. I mean, the fact that we have an electorate now, citizenry, that sees facts in a completely different light. It is or it isn't, depending upon your political point of view. And in July of last year, CNN asked Donald Trump Jr. about Democratic claims that Russia was trying to help the Trump campaign. He professed outrage. He said, and I quote, "It's disgusting. It's so phony, I can't think of bigger lies." Clearly, that statement is not true. About the promise of the offer of incriminating information on Clinton, he writes in his emails, "If it's what I say, what you say, I love it." So why doesn't that obvious fact, one negating the other, resonate throughout the support group for Donald Trump?
I find that very troublesome, the most troublesome, right? You know, once Trump was elected and he really pushed back aggressively, and all of his transition campaign pushed back aggressively about no meetings, you know, if you were a Trump supporter, you really wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, right? And for a while, really nothing came out. This looks bad. It looks really bad because it does seem to really contradict everything he said.
But that and some of the things that the president has said over time, and the accusation of a meeting with the Russians being fake news, has proven to be false. Ordinarily, you would say that would put a dent in his credibility. But does it? And it only puts a dent in his credibility with the left, not with the right. And if they don't care, does it matter?
Well, I think it puts a dent in his credibility, but also—
But who cares? Yeah, it's just that, you, I mean, lefty, liberal is, college people that care.
That is a so what factor, because his base can say, well, he didn't really, molest that woman. That's just locker talk. He didn't really have to build a wall right now, because we know that that's really tough. And I think that it's one of those things that they're willing to forgive a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to healthcare, let's see where the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm. Charles Krauthammer cares. And no one's going to confuse him with being
so
a liberal left-leaning.
So did Shepard Smith the other day on CNN.
Right.
I mean, on Fox, excuse me.
it's more easily, I think, for some staunch conservatives to dismiss Shepard Smith, right? He's someone that has drawn the ire of their criticism for a lot of different reasons, and some of them are very disturbing, right? Because they deal with who he is as a person.
Right.
But Charles Krauthammer, as recent as a month ago, said that Democrats were reaching with the Russia investigation. But he recently wrote this: I leave it to the lawyers to adjudicate the legalities of unconsummated collusion. But you don't need a lawyer to see that the Trump defense, collusion is a desperate Democratic fiction designed to explain away a lost election, is now officially dead.
And he also added, bungled collusion is still collusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from Krauthammer. We know what David Brooks will say the whole time. He's been saying about the moral compass of the Trump family, Trump himself. That's not resonating with the Trump supporters. Maybe that's what political scientists and intellectuals are really focusing on, but does the public care?
Eric?
What we know about public opinion is that partisans, and this includes both Republicans and Democrats, go to all lengths of defending the virtue of their party. So when your party is – or when someone in your party is criticized for corruption, you shift to evaluate them on some other basis. Well, the economy is good or foreign policy is good, so that's what we should be focused on, not this other stuff. If you look at the polls during Watergate, as we've said, it took 2 years between the actual event and Nixon's resignation. And even when he resigned, his approval rating was about at 23%, which is very low, but that still means that one out of four Americans thought he was doing a great job after dragging the country through this for 2 years. So the question for me is not, are people going to stick with him? Certainly his core supporters are. But what about those people who voted for him but were really ambivalent about him, who thought, well, I don't like his temperament. I distrust him, but he's better than the alternative. How are congressional Republicans who didn't endorse him, how do they play this out over the long term? We are still very early in his presidency. There's still lots of opportunities for them to
But not much is getting done. And that's beginning to be a bone of contention, is it not, among Republicans on the Hill?
Well, I mean, I'll –
because this is their moment.
Right.
It sure is. And if you look back, how are some Republicans looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, gosh, I need this guy, because he does need to persuade. Trump has the power to threaten. I'll be very angry if they go home. I'll be very upset. They better not fail to pass this. And I think if you look at that and you look at the stream of really issues about, as you said, why can't the public get more inspired by this? It was not, in, I think Eric points out, it was not just dislike of, Hillary was the poor choice. It was they hated Hillary.
Right.
I mean, people, it was a very energetic and active hatred.
The same is true on the opposite foot.
Yep.
Hillary supporters hate Donald Trump.
Well, this has been damaging to the president and to the Republican-led government. The president right now has approval ratings that are at a historic low. His disapproval rating is at about 55%. His approval rating is at 39. That's a 16-point gap. Part of the president's power is the power of persuasion. And when a president is held in such low esteem, it undermines that power of persuasion, the ability to convince members of Congress that what they should want to do is what he wants them to do is what they should want for their own selves, right? Paul Ryan recently said, well, there's a learning curve to all of this. And I'm like, I don't recall people being so patient with the previous administration dealing with that learning curve. But here's the other thing, too. In light of, everybody's like all, Game of Thrones fans, right? Winter 2018 is coming. We have midterms coming up around the corner. And so if you've run on being able to accomplish certain concrete policy objectives and you have not been able to move on those things beyond, executive orders, which can be undone by the next president, anything done by an executive order can be undone by an executive order. So if you haven't been able to make considerable advancement on this agenda under a unified government where you control the White House and both chambers of Congress, is going to raise some serious questions about your ability to govern. Now, I say all of that to say this, though. Midterm electorates tend to be different than general election electorate. So it might be possible for them to take some damage but still retain control of both chambers in 2018.
Let me share with you some things that have come in from listeners while we've been talking. Christopher emails, as someone with 32 years of Army service, your panelists saying Russia is an enemy are correct. But if people who are preparing for a job under the president have been in touch with officials from other countries and sources, you want that in your cabinet, group of advisors, etc. I'm not sure what he means by that. Guy says, please ask the panel why Putin would want Trump as president. Trump wants cheaper energy, stronger NATO, and more defense spending. Mrs. Clinton would probably continue Obama's weak and feckless foreign policy. Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well, I think part of it is simply Putin wanted to mess around with our election, cast doubt on the legitimacy.
Did Putin want Trump, or did Putin want chaos?
I think he wanted chaos.
Because he wants to undermine democracies throughout the Western world, not just the United States.
Absolutely.
Well, and also, too, during some of these hearings, you heard senators, Republican and Democrat, say this is going to happen again. It's not just the presidential election. It will happen again. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, just to follow up on the cabinet, on the, you know, what Trump said about his accomplishments, that cabinet meeting, that televised cabinet meeting, was very eerie in terms of all of his members of his cabinet. Well, yes, it is a blessing to work with you. And Trump did say no one has done more, with few exceptions. He's looking at this as a administration with accomplishments, and unfortunately, you have to accept the fact he hasn't even filled all of the positions in his administration.
And to Guy's point, right? Well, the question, why does Putin want Trump? Mm-hmm. It's a complex answer. First, it has to deal with Secretary Clinton herself. He didn't want her. That there is some antipathy between Putin and the Clintons, and he didn't want what he thought she could achieve. So one, it's not so much about him wanting Trump as much as him not wanting Clinton. Then when it does deal with Trump, Trump is someone who was on record as saying that Putin's not a bad guy, that I've met with him, he's personable, that this is someone we can work with. I think we have to move beyond some of the things of the past.
But he also said he's never met him.
But here are some of the things that can be gained, right? There are some economic sanctions that have hurt some members of the Russian elite, right? Mm-hmm. That there are some things that have been done by the United States dealing with Russia before and after evidence of this tampering that made life more difficult for people in Russia. And he would like to see those eased. And you have a better chance of getting those eased under someone that you think you can manipulate than under someone you think is going to maintain that line of sanctions and tough dealings.
More comments that have come in. Jason on Facebook, if Putin wanted Trump to win, isn't the Republican agenda Putin's agenda? I think that's a stretch, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that the majority of Republicans in Congress are not on the same wavelength as Trump on Russia. And I think that's where we would expect to see more immediate splits between Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration.
Clayton on Facebook writes, get over it. Russia didn't tell me who to vote for. Just stop. Democrats are sore losers and have blocked everything from this administration. I find this fascinating. I really do.
I guess we can all go home now.
I'm not sure it's true that Democrats even have the ability to block anything in this administration, but it is certainly true that Republicans did their best to block everything in the Obama administration. So are Democrats sore losers? Is this about the Democrats?
I mean, Democrats may be sore losers. We've seen the Secretary Clinton, you know, grieving 2008, grieving 2016. So there's some evidence of sour grapes, but there's also some evidence of things that ought to be concerning for all Americans, regardless of ideology, regardless of party.
All right. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's River Jam Concert Series, Thursday and Saturday nights now through September. Live music featuring regional and national acts each week, usnwc.org. And America's biopharmaceutical companies, every day 140,000 researchers across the country, including thousands in North Carolina, search for tomorrow's breakthrough cures. More information at goboldly.com. Well, coming up on Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the Senate unveils its revised health care bill. A panel of health care experts go over what's in it and where it goes from here. That's coming up. You can join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE. Tweet us at Charlotte Talks. Also find us on Facebook at WFAE. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. I think that covers all the bases. Oh, and watch us on Facebook Live.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
We have news this morning of the death of a Chinese dissident. His name was Liu Xiaobo.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
CMPD Chief Kerr Putney says Officer Philip Barker was driving 100 miles an hour when he sped through the intersection of Moorhead Street and Euclid Avenue just after 3 a.m.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Trump presidency thus far and the drip, 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 the drop, drop, drop of shoes, etc. Elizabeth Amato is with Gardner-Webb University, Eric Heberle with UNC Charlotte, Susan Roberts with Davidson College, and Adolphus Belk from Winthrop University, political scientists all. Rod, this could be an email, I don't know, says, how much of the resistance by Mr. Trump's supporters is due to most people's inability to even suspect that they may have actually voted for the wrong person? How much of it is, I'm going to dig my heels in now because I voted for this guy?
I think statistically, if you look at it, people tend to misremember who they voted for, right? Like over time, that's I think what studies show is people actually will.
It's only been less than a year.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Short memories.
I mean, when you look at it, though, to Elizabeth's point, right, like when a president is being inaugurated, more people will say that they voted right for the president than actually voted for the president, right?
Because they want to be on the winning side.
Yeah, there's this honeymoon period. People like winners, and they give the president a shot. And one of the things we've observed is that with the Trump administration, his disapproval rating became higher than his approval rating in historically quick fashion. It happened in 8 days. With most presidents, it takes hundreds of days. It happened in 8 days. So a lot of Americans are starting to look at him in a more critical way. And you've seen a lot of these think pieces recently from different major news sources talking about disaffected white working class voters that are now having second thoughts about having supported Mr. Trump, in part because of what might happen with health care.
Eventually, we're going to know, I would think, or we're going to reach a conclusion about what happened with regard to this Russia stuff, which eventuality will have the greater impact on the country and on the voters and on this schism in the population, the fact that he's found innocent or the fact that he's found guilty?
The next shoe may be, I was trying to think, what's the next shoe that could drop? And that is that Trump knew the meeting took place. He was in Trump Tower. They were in Trump Tower. I think that will be something that moves the discussion beyond just
but
he was
But how will that impact? Whether ultimately there was no collusion and there's no evidence of collusion, the president was right all along, he had nothing to do with it, he knew nothing. Or he knew everything about it, he encouraged it, there was collusion. Which is going to have the worst impact? Which outcome will have the worst impact?
I mean, and I think it depends on what arena. The electoral arena, the political arena in terms of getting things passed. And for many people, and myself included, I care about the leadership and the moral compass of the White House. But will it hurt Trump, who has already filed for re-election? Will it hurt him in 2020? I think that's a long way away.
Getting back to a listener's comment about getting over things and that the Democrats are sore losers, former Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine from Virginia characterized these revelations last week as moving the Russian investigation into the realms of, quote, perjury, false statements, and even potentially treason. Does that help underline this feeling of sore loser, the use of the word treason at this point in the conversation?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, there are some Democrats who are sort of gaslighting all of this with their language and their rhetoric, right, because people are angry and they want to see something come of this. But if we can look at it for a moment in a dispassionate sort of way, We already know that Russia made an effort to influence the outcome of the election. That is a matter of national security that should have everyone hopping mad, right? And so we can put that on one side. Now, the second issue, what did President Trump know? When did he know it? That's a separate issue. If we're dealing with the first alone, we have a national security crisis, because if they've tried us once, they'll try us again, and that's something that needs to be dealt with. If the second thing turns out to be true, then we have a constitutional crisis, because now you're talking about undermining confidence, trust, effectiveness in a major American governmental institution, and then people looking at Congress, which is supposed to have the wherewithal to deal with this, not dealing with it. Those are two issues that are related that present different challenges.
All of this is preventing a lot of forward movement of the Republican and the Trump agenda, whatever that may be. But both want to change health care policy, both the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Both want tax reform. The president has said that he wants some sort of infrastructure bill. Health care has been bogged down. Tax reform hasn't started. We have no details about any infrastructure vision. If these things don't happen within the first 6 months of a presidency, or if they don't happen by the end of this year, what are the chances that they will happen at all? Any of them?
It definitely makes it more difficult, historically speaking. You know, the reason the media focuses on this honeymoon period is because historically that's when it's been easiest for presidents to get things done. And the key reason for that historically is because that's when presidents have the highest popularity rating, when the opposition party bows to the result of the election and doesn't criticize the president's policy proposals as much. This year, we haven't seen that. I mean, the opposition party has been attacking from the get-go. Trump's popularity ratings have been very low, to the extent that Russia has been a distraction to the Republican policy agenda. It's because we're tweeting about Russia rather than him using the bully pulpit of the president to explain to us why their health care plan is an improvement over Obamacare.
John McCain has said all of this is sucking the oxygen out of the room. Texas Republican Mike McCall says this is taking Republicans off message when the message should be a unified Congress standing up to Russia and Putin. But North Carolina Representative Mark Meadows, who is chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, claims that we're all focused on the agenda. So who's right?
Mike Pence.
He's being honest here.
Mike Pence said that too, but he also added, and I wasn't involved with anything that happened before I came on the ticket.
Adolphus.
I look at it and say this. When we look at the executive branch as an institution, we know that over the years it's taken legislative initiative and has the ability to sort of get things rolling when it comes to developing and pursuing a legislative agenda. But it also deals with an enforcement mechanism. And while much might not be moving right now when it comes to developing new policies, there is still something to be said about implementing and interpreting existing policies. And we know that Mr. Trump, Steve Bannon, and others believe that Washington is a major part of the problem. And they've talked about undoing the deep state. They've appointed people to administrative positions that seem to be somewhat hostile to the agency's agenda or how that agenda has been interpreted by the prior administration. We look at Betsy DeVos in education. We look at the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, in the Department of Justice and other places, and they're charting a very different mission for those agencies when compared to their predecessors. And so I think we need to look at the agenda in two ways. They might not be moving things through, but they've certainly tried to change the course of what's being done to enforce existing legislation.
Meanwhile, a California Democrat, I didn't know this until I read this last week, has filed an article of impeachment against the president in a bid to remove him from office. Brad Sherman accuses Trump of obstructing investigations into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, in part because he fired former FBI Director James Comey. He calls this the first step in a very long road. Isn't this a bit premature? Is it helpful at this point in our political life for a Democrat to be filing an article of impeachment?
I think some of it is being symbolic, and I think you can raise that point, and it might get reported, but it's going to be here and gone. I think it is premature. I think that it takes a long time, whether, you know, we call it impeachable offense. It took a long time. I was one that said when the Monica Lewinsky issue came out, I said, well, he's going to be impeached. He's going to be out of office. And
but impeachment doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to be out of office.
But then I thought he was going to be out of office. And I think that for Trump, impeachment is something that I don't know that, you know, he doesn't, there's not much substance for him in looking at the Constitution. I also am very concerned about the fact that he has, as Adolphus said, changed the direction, appointed people who are loosely amateurs.
But isn't that his right, and isn't that what his supporters wanted him to do?
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. That's what they were looking for, and I think that's what his supporters are most happy about and why they're kind of holding and reserving their strong criticism.
Well, I also think, though, you have to, and I agree, you have to also look at, you've got people in his administration that may be weaker in terms of establishment experience, but also you're looking at, again, things that are important to all of us here and that and their listeners, and that's a blatant disregard for the legislative process. If you look at how this health care, Mitch McConnell, it's almost like I want to hurry up and write a bad paper that isn't really due, and not use any resources. I just think that it's an issue that goes beyond just the context, and I think we need to look closely at those people he's appointed and how they can keep us on the right course.
I forgot which paper this was in this morning, the New York Times or the Observer, probably the Times. There seems to be a definite split within the Republican Party on which way the party should go, which way the country should go, which policies we should adopt and how severe they should be. And these two sides within the party aren't speaking to each other.
What we've seen over time is a hollowing out of the middle with both parties. The middle is pretty useless when we talk about the general electorate, right? Your true independent is the least likely to be informed, the least likely to follow politics, least likely to register, least likely to vote. But when you talk about the middle inside the halls of government, that's where deals get made because those moderates are able to bring people together and compromise on some issues. Now, all compromises are not great, and some compromises can be quite terrible. But the point is you have people that have relationships that are willing to talk to one another, and they serve as the bridge builders between the parties. Their numbers have thinned out at the national level, and it makes it more difficult to get deals done.
What happens when the cold civil war is not just between Democrats and Republicans, left and right, conservatives and liberals, but between people within the party itself, be it Republican or Democrat?
Well, this is something that deeply disturbed me. When we look at the shooting that took place in Northern Virginia just a few weeks ago, it didn't take long for people to pivot from, hopes and prayers for those who were injured to using this as a way to bash the other party for a failed policy position. And I'm like, people are still in a hospital. The Capitol Police who defended them were still in a hospital. And this is where we're talking. So, nothing is sacred and nothing is out of bounds and everything is up for discussion.
I know that there have been periods in our history where things have gotten pretty tense. Well, Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton, for instance. But I mean, they used to have fist fights and cane fights on the floor of the House and Senate in the 1860s. Is there any historical precedent for what's happening right now in the split within the parties and between the parties?
The parties now are actually more united
okay.
than they have been through much of our lifetimes. On policy, what we're seeing now is largely divisions over tactics. How aggressive should we be in trying to get everything we want now versus compromising and getting a little bit at a time? What we also see, particularly in healthcare, is a distinction between what we call messaging politics, which is taking positions that will never actually become law, versus actual policymaking. The Republicans are getting stuck now because they voted 60 times to repeal Obamacare without an actual plan to do so. And actually having a plan to do so, they're finding, is actually much tougher than just saying, right, we want to get rid of something that's unpopular.
This is what makes it stunning when a veteran like Paul Ryan says, well, it's different when you're the opposition party and you become the ruling party. And it's like, you've been around long enough to know that.
So Trump has made promises not only about repealing and replacing Obamacare, but about replacing it with something better than Obamacare. What's been proposed both in the House and Senate doesn't appear on many fronts to be as good as Obamacare. So he doesn't seem to understand what's in these bills, but when he finds out, what has been his response?
Well, the first one, the House bill, he said was mean. And I think, too, that President Trump has – you have to look back. And here's another theme. How do we look back and say, what did he say during the campaign and what did he do? First 100 days, I'm going to do this first day in office. He said, I think we can repeal and replace Obamacare
quickly.
The same day.
Yeah.
And that indeed is not true. I think the Republicans are stuck. Some of these, as we've talked about, they're different coalitions. But you look at, I mean, Lisa Murkowski, a fourth of the people in Alaska are on some form of Medicaid.
So because so few pieces of legislation have gone through or even being proposed, the only thing we can talk about really is health care. So what happens if something passes and it's signed into law and it isn't as good as Obamacare, that people, millions of people do lose coverage, or they're paying high premiums for nothing, that insurance companies are now being able to issue so-called junk policies. What happens to Trump? What happens to Republicans if that happens?
The Congressional Budget Office, in their score in May, said that 23 million people would lose insurance if this plan were to go through. And so when you talk about the consequences for real living Americans, they would be dire. One of the major consequences would be people not being extended coverage because they have pre-existing conditions or because they're considered to be a greater risk and their costs would be really high. So it's going to mean something for actual Americans. As far as the administration is concerned, if you've promised all along and if you're a party, you've promised all along that you would take this on and give something better and it turns out to be immediately inferior, you're in big trouble.
And you own it. It's really yours. They can no longer blame that on Democrats.
Toby emails, until all Americans have a better understanding of how our democracy actually works, political science should be required in high school, in parentheses, this type of problem will continue. However, in the New York Times over the weekend, Joshua Green wrote a new Pew Research poll, and Republican-leaning independents now believe, says that Republican independents now believe, that colleges and universities have a negative impact on the country. This number is up sharply from the 45% who agreed with this same statement last year. So you're the problem.
It's not the first time I've been told
that.
That's
right. I want to have a job. I want health insurance, you know.
Dr. Susan Roberts, Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. Dr. Eric Heberle, Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Adolphus Belk, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Winthrop University. And Elizabeth Amato, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Gardner-Webb University. Thank you all for the hour.